morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Amidst all the contemporary turmoil and vocal screeching of imminent disaster, disruption, and dishonesty that accompanies American election years, it might be reasonable to commemorate the birthday of a great historical city of what was once abjectly considered the New World, actually half of global planet Earth. The oldest Yankee Doodle pioneer city of the North American USA celebrates its 213th birthday tomorrow, April 12th, Astoria, Oregon, platted in the year 1811, which, of course, displaced a multi-millennia civilization that preceded Euro-Yankee intrusion and had inhabited the shores of the Great River of the West, and the Great River of the West that was the dynamic lifeline of the decimated native culture was named after the great European navigator, Old C.C. himself, in honor of his own great claim discovery. And that should be in quotes with a question mark, 3 centuries earlier, which was not only a great surprise to half the round world's human inhabitants, whose own great civilizations were eradicated as though they never existed or worth preserving. The major determinant of the superior strength of the ravaging intruders that decimated New World human culture was the invention of gunpowder a few centuries earlier, as well, of course, their great sailing ships that proved able to circle the world's oceans. Connie Rose Anderson wrote a story for the now-defunct North Coast Times-Eagle in the first year of this new millennium that encompasses both cultures, the native and alien, of early Astoria, which was initially established as a fur trading outpost 10 miles inland of the mouth of the Columbia River in 1811. The Distinguished Princess by Connie Rose Anderson. Celiast Helen Smith has been dead since 1891, so she probably doesn't have an opinion of her epitaph. I think it stinks. I discovered the metal plaque embedded in a large rock in the middle of the Pioneer Cemetery, an open and windy little graveyard on the Clatsop Plains, which was originally established in 1846 to accommodate the bodies of shipwreck victims that were frequently found on the beach in those days. Today, the cemetery is bordered on the west by Camp Rialia, a National Guard and police training camp, and on the east by Coast Highway 101. I was more than vaguely aware of the steady drone of summer tourist traffic as I stood reading the inscription. Beneath this native stone lie Oregon's first school teachers, Solomon Howard Smith of New Hampshire, pioneer, missionary, wheelwright, farmer, merchant, state senator, and his wife Helen, born Celiast, Prince's daughter of Gobaway, chief of the Clatsops. And the gravestones, Solomon Howard Smith, 1809 to 1876, and Helen Celiast Smith, 1801 to 1891. So here was our man, Solomon, single-handedly building a nation. And where was his partner, Celiast, all that time? Hanging around the cabin, sipping mineral water, and planning her spring wardrobe, having her hair done and pushing back cuticles, After all, this woman spent 23 more years here than her dynamic husband, and all this historian has to say about her, aside from a reference to a mom and dad teaching stint, is that she was born to male Cobbleway and married to male Smith. With the image of this slothful creature lolling at the back of my mind, I began in my wanderings through local history to notice her name frequently, usually in brief incidental passages. I started taking notes, and slowly, through many rainy days, historical journals and files of notes and records kept by local pioneers and their descendants, Celia's story emerged. Clearly, this woman has been struck with an unfair epitaph. Celia's was 4 years old when her father, Cobbleway, as chief of a Clotsop tribe, greeted Lewis and Clark at the mouth of the Columbia River. Cobbleway ruled during the last of an era when his and the other Chinook tribes were rapidly being decimated by diseases brought by the white man. By the time Celiast was of marriageable age, the empire of Cobbleway had faded to a 20th of its previous population. As was customary in her culture, Celiast married to strengthen the position of her tribe. The Clotsop Indians, it seems, were no slouches in the business world, and when the white man arrived, they recognized power and a hell of a new market and welcomed the whites with inflated prices and enthusiastic prospective social ties. Sometime in the 1820s, Celiast was given in marriage, quote unquote, to Frank Poirier, a baker with Dr. John McLaughlin's company of soldiers and traders at Fort Vancouver, Washington. With Poirier, she had two sons and survived the changes forced upon her as a squaw, and that's in quotes, wife in the early Western pioneer movement. One of the major differences, probably, between Celiast's native culture and that of the highly moralistic and sternly religious settlement ruled by Dr. McLaughlin, Little King, quote unquote, of the Oregon Territory, was the whites' horrified attitude toward polygamy. The Chinook tribe's tradition was that any man worth his salt should afford to keep several wives. Imagine Celia's surprise when, having learned to restructure her own beliefs to accommodate the white man's, it was discovered in 1832 that Frank Poirier already had a wife and child in Canada. Imagine, too, Celia's audience before Dr. McLaughlin, whose tall, stiff form inspired the Indians to refer to him as the Great White Eagle. Ever formal in his long blue coat and brass buttons, the proctor must have towered over the short, barefoot squaw, and with the glory of his unforgiving religion in his icy blue eyes, informed Celiast, in a voice oiled by Christian self-righteousness, that he had decided that she must leave her husband and children forever and be shuffled off to French Prairie to live with her sister, Ye August. He was eager, I'm sure, to remove this embarrassment from his Christian domain. McLaughlin, it is recorded, kept his own squaw, again in quotes, wife in Purdah. In this instance, the tradition of the seclusion of Indian women of rank. She did not sit with him at meals and was kept totally out of the picture whenever visitors arrived at the fort and were entertained in McLaughlin's baronial style. So it is easy to believe that he felt no qualms in commanding this squat, slope-browed native woman to abandon her children and move even further away from her homeland and the few surviving remnants of her tribe. Enter Solomon Smith. Having arrived at Fort Vancouver as a schoolteacher with the Wythe Expedition of 1832, Solomon Smith had known Celiast briefly before her disgraced departure from the fort. In 1834, he followed her to French Prairie and, in traditional Indian contract style, joined Celiast in marriage. It was at French Prairie, then, that the two of them performed the teaching stint for which, interestingly, Celiast is given credit at her gravesite. Celiast wasn't happy in French Prairie, and by 1840 was able to use her considerable persuasive powers to convince Solomon to move with her back to the Clatsop Plains, scene of her childhood, and establish a homestead. Now Solomon begins to shine, introducing several new crops to the area, building a personal farming empire for himself and a few select friends, some of whom were even half-breeds, the journals are proud to point out, and racking up a long list of business and political ventures. And such a thoughtful man. One historian smugly points out that even after white women finally appeared on the Clatsop Plains, he never abandoned or rejected Celiast, even though he was probably referred to as a squaw man. I had to dig a little harder to find out what Celiast was doing all that time. Mostly little things like saving lives, both white and Indian, preventing numerous incidents of bloodshed and one potential all-out war, working alongside Solomon in the farming labors, aiding the newly arrived pioneer families by helping them become established and teaching them compatibility with their new environment, and on the side, raising 6 children of her own and 3 foster children. Of course, there is no way of knowing the actual number of times Celiast's talents as mediator were used in the transition period between the last of the Indian culture and the new, fast-growing pioneer era. But a few such incidents are recorded, apparently authentic, in that they are often duplicated in separate records or accounts. A rather impressive account of such an incident took place between Reverend John Frost, the local missionary, and Katata, a somewhat hostile headman of the Clatsops. Acting on a grudge involving a stolen and retrieved hatchet, Katata was discovered leveling a musket at Frost, preparing to blow his head off. Celiast ran from her cabin and grabbed Katata by his long hair, jerking him off his feet and publicly embarrassing him. She then brandished her wisely maintained prestige as Kabawe's daughter to prevent any further repercussions. Another account describes Celiast hiding W.W. Raymond, a lay member of the Methodist mission, in her root cellar for 4 days while performing massive amounts of public relations work and mediating with an angry tribe that was after the man's hide. W.S. Kenny of Seaside is credited with recording the story of how Celiast stopped a potential bloody uprising. Apparently bent on revenge for the killing of an Indian by Thomas Owens, a white settler, a number of Clatsops and Tillamooks who had banded together with the intentions of a total massacre were intercepted by Celiast, who was able to convince the party to return home, and the band finally dispersed. One source states that on this occasion, Celiast, quote, perhaps prevented war in the whole territory, unquote. no one to show partiality. Celiast is described in yet another journal, putting the brakes to her own husband in his incautious attempt to do in an Indian in a fracas over an insult to Solomon's hired boy. And they sent him to Congress and kept her home on the farm. Between babies and heroic rescues, Celiast adopted Eli, an orphaned French-Canadian boy, and Bill Stoddard, a half-breed. Several accounts also refer to Celiast's purchase of Jessie Bill, a Hawaiian girl whom she bought from a sailor as a slave. Celiast eventually adopted Jessie Bill and raised her as one of her own children. As the first pioneer family to settle on the Clatsop Plains, Solomon and Celiast Smith were greatly depended upon to help those who followed. Their home served as temporary quarters for countless individuals and families while new shelters were being built. It was Celiast's responsibility to organize the crowded and ever-changing household and to feed the large groups that gathered for the meals. Many of these new pioneers were totally unfamiliar with the climate and environment, and Celiast was a source of information on the gathering and preparing of indigenous edible plants and wildlife. To the new settlers, she passed on her knowledge of the best methods for collecting clams, mussels, roots, and local berries, and shared her Indian methods of cooking the fresh products or drying them for year-round use. The years and changes, the loss of her tribe, and the loss of her first two children were hard on Celiast. There is no mention anywhere as to whether she ever again saw or had any knowledge of those two young boys that were taken from her at Fort Vancouver. Her picture, taken in her middle years, suggests that she never forgot them. Finally, in 1876, when Solomon died and the children were grown, one, Silas, a New Hampshire attorney, Celiast sought peace and simplicity and reverted back to the Indian ways of her youth, living quietly on Clatsop Plains, speaking her native language, and practicing her original Indian way of life as much as possible in the altered environment. In 1891, she died and was buried beside Solomon in the Pioneer Cemetery. I don't know when the plaque was embedded on Celiast's gravestone, but it obviously happened back when women were still being defined by their relationships with a man or men. Let's not kid ourselves that this particular injustice is not still going on today. Here lies Celiast, teacher and appendage to Cobbaway, and then appendage to Solomon. Let's give Celiast equal time on this rock. This woman is a symbol of a graceful and dignified transition between two eras and two cultures. Her story shows a person whose dealings with others, both Indians and whites, were based on respect and equality. She also represents the proud dignity, instinctive wisdom, and strength of a now extinct race. The last full-blooded Clatsop Indian died in 1905. I would like to see her epitaph changed to read, "And his wife, Celiast, distinguished princess of the Clatsop Indians, pioneer, educator, naturalist, mediator, stateswoman, philanthropist, farmer, and mother." Aren't there any women on that Pioneer Cemetery board? And that was The Distinguished Princess by Connie Rose Anderson, who used to live in Cannon Beach, and it was published by the North Coast Times Eagle, of which I was editor-publisher at the time. And now, I would like to read a poem by Rick Vranya. He died several years ago. He was a poet and a cartographer. And his poem is Astor Library. Hushed school children, bookworms, and clicking computer users in this large reading room fill a rainy Saturday sitting under a poster reading, "A library is not a luxury, but one of the necessities of life." Outside, in the gray rain, the north wall stucco has long lost the last two letters of the town's name, and so it reads, Astor Library. Fitting reminder it is of the East Coast entrepreneur who never saw and may not have known of this place. Somewhere out there in a wild northwest that may as well have been the Far East was his trading post for otter pelts before they decimated the otter, before they decimated the seals, before they decimated the almost endless salmon, while on land were likewise decimated the large cats, wolves, black bear, the ancient enormous trees, the people of old tested communities, all documented in the very fine museum that shows us what was lost and what remains, a struggling American seaport fish town striving toward survival, conceived not so much in malice as in ignorance, the inevitable prize of some sort of enterprise rich men call free. And that was by Rick Vanya. This is Michael McCusker. Jack Harris is radio engineer for today's program. I am not certain what the word for this year, 2024, is selected to be, but I think vermin should be a contender. The term Donald Trump has used to describe the majority of Americans who oppose his grotesque ambition to be dictator of the USA. And happy 41st birthday to KMUN, Free Radio Pacific, which rocketed into the airwaves with the immortal voice of Liam Dunn on April 12, 1983. Happy birthday, KMUN.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.